Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is Latin America. Today's episode is part of the special Transition 2021 series on the President's Inbox. In the weeks running up to Inauguration Day, I'm sitting down with experts to discuss the foreign policy challenges facing the incoming Biden administration. With me to discuss how President-elect Joe Biden will handle U.S. policy toward Latin America are Paul Angelo and Shannon O'Neill. Paul is a fellow for Latin America Studies at the Council, focusing on security and justice in the Americas. He was previously a political officer at the U.S. Embassy in Honduras as part of CFR's International Affairs Fellowship, and he served as an active-duty U.S. naval officer in Colombia and the United Kingdom. Shannon is Vice President, Deputy Director of Studies, and Nelson and David Rockefeller Senior Fellow for Latin America Studies at CFR. She is an expert on Latin America, global trade, U.S.-Mexico relations, corruption, democracy, and immigration. Shannon is the author of the book Two Nations Indivisible, Mexico, the United States, and the Road Ahead. And sometime in 2021, her newest book, with the working title of America First, Puts America Last, will be coming out from Yale University Press. Paul and Shannon, thanks for joining me today.
Great to be with you.
Thanks, Jim, for having me back on the President's Inbox.
I want to discuss how a President Biden will likely handle relations with Latin America. But before we go there, I'd like to begin with your assessments of how President Trump handled U.S. relations in the region. Maybe I could ask you to go first, Shannon.
Sure. Well, we look back at the last 4 years, I would say U.S.-Latin American relations overall, and then we can talk about specific countries, but overall was fairly personalistic. It was quite transactional, and overall, it was limited. So this was a personalistic relationship. A lot of U.S.-Latin America policy came out of the White House itself, not out of all of the different agencies, the State Department, Homeland Security, DOD, whatever, whichever ones you're referring to. It was really run out of White House and guided by Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law. So it was a much more contained policy than usual. It was quite transactional. One of the big things that the Trump administration cared a lot about was migration. So you saw a lot of, you know, pushing on governments or threatening or even withdrawing aid if they didn't, quote unquote, behave on migration issues. And so that especially pertained to Central America, but it was also part of Venezuela policy or other policies around the region, given that migration became such a big issue for all of Latin America over the last 4 years. And then I would say it was a pretty limited agenda. Migration was up there on top. There was some drug policy and particularly focus on eradication of Colombian coca and the like. But other than that, we did not see a lot of the usual things that are in U.S. Latin America policy. We did not see a big focus on democracy. We did not see a big focus on anti-corruption issues. We didn't see really a big focus on the role of China, which increased a lot in the region over the last 4 years. It was a pretty small and pretty limited agenda, I would say, under the Trump administration.
Paul, how would you assess the way the Trump administration approached Latin America?
I would reiterate what Shannon had said about the transactional nature of the Trump administration's Latin America policy. And as a consequence, I think U.S. standing in the region is greatly eroded going into 2021. I think that's an erosion that started really with the 2008, the Great Recession, and sort of the disastrous management of U.S. financial markets. But I think the Trump administration laid bare many of the deficiencies here in the United States, particularly with regard to the Trump administration's mismanagement of the COVID-19 crisis in the United States. President Trump's refusal to recognize the electoral result outright in the U.S. presidential election, and overall a policy of denigrating our allies and partners in the region, even at one point saying that Colombia, the most significant strategic partner in the hemisphere, had done nothing for the U.S. government during the war on drugs, which, you know, was a huge affront to an important partnership in the region. The narrow agenda that Shannon referenced, I think, would also extend to the leftist-run or left-wing governments of the region that were referred to by the Trump administration as the Troika of Tyranny. And there we're talking about Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Cuba. And I think a lot of the Trump administration's policy preferences in the region, and really the only focus that we saw on human rights and anti-corruption, targeted those three countries because there was an electoral calculus in the critical battleground state of Florida.
So you both have described a policy coming out of the Trump administration that is, in some sense, both narrow and shallow. I want to flip the question around now and ask how Joe Biden's victory is viewed in the region. I'll do the caveat at the beginning. We have 36 countries in the region, so I'm not going to ask you to run through each and every one of them. But I ask sort of how countries have reacted, in part because I note that Mexican President López Obrador has been slow to recognize Biden's victory. Same thing with President Bolsonaro in Brazil. And of course, this is laid against a historical backdrop of occasional tensions, can we put it, between the United States and Latin America. So I don't know whether having a narrow, limited American policy toward the region might actually be perceived, at least in some countries, as a blessing. Shannon?
So I think it depends who you ask. If you are a populist leader with a big illiberal domestic agenda, then you're not looking forward to Biden coming back, because I expect a Biden administration will be much more institutional in its approach. You will see the return of the State Department, of these different departments working together and, you know, the kind of quote unquote famous interagency process to develop policy. But that means a lot of actors, a lot of experts back involved in these policies. I think you're going to see a much more values based element to U.S. Latin America policy. So return of caring about democracy, democratic checks and balances, anti-corruption, and the like. I think you're going to see new issues on the table, things like environment and labor issues, which we can talk about those all. But overall, if you are someone who has quite liked the absence of the U.S., and I think there, López Obrador in Mexico, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil are two candidates, then you're not all that pleased. And I think that's part of, not the only reason, that we haven't seen a quick recognition of President-elect Biden. But if you are the general Latin America public, I think a lot of people are really happy about a return of Biden. The Trump administration and Trump himself was particularly unpopular among Latin American publics, if you look at public opinion polls and the like. So they're happy to have a different change in government. I think there are a lot of reformers in the region. Not all of them are presidents, but some of them are in the Congresses or in other parts of the government or in civil society and NGOs. I think they're happy to have a U.S. that comes back and has a fuller agenda and is more interested in all these different parts of things happening in the region that would support transparency and openness and some of these issues. So I think you see, and you do see whether people are looking forward to it or are quite trepidatious about it, there is a recognition that Biden and the team that is coming in really know the region well. Biden was the point person for Latin America during the Obama administrations as vice president. He took dozens of trips down to the region. He also knew it as a former senator involved in the Foreign Relations Committee. So I do see a recognition of his knowledge and expertise and that those that are surrounding him as well. So that cuts both ways, but overall, I think there's a relief in the region among many that you're seeing a new U.S. administration.
I want to come back, Shannon, to the question of how Biden views Latin America. But first, I want to get Paul to talk a little bit about how the countries he spends a lot of time thinking about and studying are reacting to it. I'm thinking here, obviously, Colombia, looking at countries in Central America, particularly the Northern Triangle, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Venezuela, which has been a sore spot in U.S. foreign policy for a while. What's your read on how those countries are reacting to Biden's election, Paul?
Sure. I would coincide with Shannon on saying that there are some leaders in the region who would feel trepidation about Biden's victory, namely the budding authoritarian populists, to include President Bukele in El Salvador, who, you know, recognize that the Biden administration will hold their feet to the fire on issues of corruption, on lack of protections for the environment, etc. But I think for many in the region, Biden's victory will come as a relief. We can all recall that the Trump administration sought to resurrect the Monroe Doctrine. The United States government perceived right to interfere in the domestic affairs of Latin American governments and sort of a treatment of the region as our own backyard. But the Biden campaign has rejected that language outright. And Biden recognizes that our own success and stability in this country are inextricably linked to the prosperity of our neighbors in Latin America. And I think the United States is playing host to the Summit of the Americas next year will be a good opportunity for the United States to revive a longstanding commitment in the hemisphere to multilateralism, which will be something that many countries in the region will welcome. With regards to the bilateral relationships that you mentioned, Jim, I think the U.S.-Colombia relationship will continue to be a strategic partnership that the Biden-Harris administration will leverage. But also, I think the Biden-Harris administration will look to Colombia for regional leadership. I think, you know, when it comes to the U.S.-Colombia relationship, there may be an initial cold shoulder given that members of the ruling party were actively campaigning on behalf of President Trump in critical battleground states like Florida. However, I think there is a recognition on both sides of the bilateral relationship that the U.S.-Colombia relationship is too important for regional stability. And I think that a workable and deepening partnership will result in the first years of the Biden administration. Likewise, in Central America, Central America is a region right now that has long faced endemic corruption, chronic poverty, violence, and is increasingly susceptible to the effects of climate change. We saw that Central America just had two back-to-back Category 4 hurricanes, which have resulted in the massive displacement of people, the destruction of livelihoods. Some 90% of bean and corn crops have been wiped spiked out in the Northern Triangle countries. And we've seen an increased politicization of the distribution of humanitarian assistance in the region. In a country like Honduras, this is coming on the heels of three consecutive droughts. And so I think one of the first foreign policy crises that the Biden-Harris administration will face in 2021 will be a Central American migrant crisis on the U.S.-Mexico border. This isn't to say that all of the conditions that led to the last migrant crisis during the Obama administration had disappeared. Central America, and particularly the Northern Triangle countries, remain among the most violent in the world, have very high impunity rates for crime, and we've seen an acceleration of democratic backsliding. President Bukele in El Salvador is poised to take over the Salvadoran legislature. In February, we saw mass protests over the past several weeks in Guatemala over corruption and a presidential budget that sought to slash assistance programs in public health and education. And in the case of Honduras, President Juan Orlando Hernandez remains a co-conspirator in his brother's drug crimes. So when it comes to the reformers that we might want to deal with in Central America, or that we have had in positions of influence and power in the past, we won't be looking to the executive. And in fact, I think our biggest allies in Central America will be the private sector and civil society. And then finally, when it comes to Venezuela, I think there's an opportunity with the Biden administration that we didn't have with the maximum pressure campaign that was being waged by the Trump administration. If anything, the maximum pressure, all options on the table campaign to unseat Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela further entrenched Maduro. Firstly, it gave hope to the opposition coalition led by Juan Guaido that the solution to Venezuela's political crisis would come from abroad, which was never going to be the case. But secondly, the imposition of maximum sanctions against all sectors of society have caused a strain for Maduro, but haven't led to his removal because they failed to create the kind of fissures within the regime that would have been necessary for his ouster. So I think that we have an opportunity with the Biden administration, not to say that the Biden administration is going to repeal sanctions and go directly to the negotiating table with Nicolas Maduro, but I do think that it will force the opposition coalition to tack in a different direction. And I think the signaling and the rhetoric coming out of the Biden campaign was such that there's unequivocal support for the opposition coalition and the restoration of free and fair elections in Venezuela and a peaceful transition. And I think that the Biden administration will use multilateral channels, will leverage its relationship with the other democracies of the Americas, its transatlantic relationships, firstly to implement targeted sanctions against members of the regime, their family members, shell companies that are moving and hiding money for them across the world, but also express support for the Venezuelan people. I should remind you that 5 million Venezuelans have fled their country over the past 5 years. There are 7 million Venezuelans who are internally displaced. This is the second largest humanitarian crisis in the world on the heels of the Syrian crisis and the largest humanitarian crisis in the recent history of the Western Hemisphere. And so I think that the initial opportunity when it comes to Venezuela will be for the Biden administration to support the Venezuelan people by corralling international assistance.
There's a lot there, Paul. I want to come back particularly to the migration crisis issue, maybe a little bit more in Venezuela. Before we do that, Shannon, I wanted to draw you out on the point you made about Joe Biden being somebody who has experience in dealing with Latin America. He was the point person on the issue latter half of the Obama administration. But from everything I can tell, Latin America looks different today than it did 5, 6, 7 years ago. And what kind of challenges does that present to Joe Biden's view of the world, but also how do you think he's going to prioritize Latin America versus all the other issues he's going to have to worry about as president?
It does look a lot different. And I think that's going to be a challenge, is changing the framework. And you know what I would characterize when Biden was down in Latin America and working on these issues, overall, it was a more hopeful place than it is today. And so 2020 itself has been a difficult year, but the last 4 years have been pretty difficult. And so across the region, we've seen a regression in democracy. So you look at, you know, Freedom House or other types of measures, and many countries have fallen down the partly free scale, and two have fallen into the not free category, which are Venezuela and Nicaragua. So that's something different. We've seen the anti-corruption campaigns that were leading the beginning of the 2010s, sort of Lava Jato in Brazil, which brought down a former president, lots of members of Congress, big business leaders that had spread regionally. You saw a lot of these, or also big anti-corruption campaigns in Guatemala and other places. Those really faltered, and some of them have failed. So that momentum that he had seen is gone now. He had been moving around the region when the region was doing pretty well economically. It was a time of a decade long boom, tens of millions of people moving into the middle class and those sorts of things. And that too has faded. Even before COVID, we saw Latin American economies on the whole stagnating. And we've seen tens of millions of people moving into poverty because of the economic crisis associated with the health pandemic. And we've also seen over these last 4 years, a huge uptick in migration, as Paul was talking about. And yes, Biden is familiar with migration. In fact, in 2014, he was a person really leading the U.S. response to Central American migration in that year. But over the last 4 years, we've seen another million Central Americans. And as Paul was talking about, 4 million Venezuelans just in those 4 years moving out of their country. So the scale of the migration crisis in the Western Hemisphere is very different than what we've faced in you know, recent or current history before. So all of these things are going to be on Biden's plate, and I think are going to take a different mindset and also set of challenges. And it's really going to be rebuilding some of the institutions that have been eroded in terms of democracy, in terms of anti-corruption, in terms of checks and balances and governance and rule of law, in terms of violence in different countries. And then also helping Latin American countries deal with these twin crises. One is migration and the movement of people. So those millions of people, they need help, but the countries that are absorbing them also need help because they're overwhelmed from many of their social systems and schools and the like. And this is also a year, just to remember, 2021 is one of the electoral super cycle years for Latin America. So there's lots of presidential elections that are going to happen, important midterms as well. So that is an immediate crisis for the Biden administration, and part of U.S. Latin America relations is going to be the migration side of things. And the other is going to be COVID. Latin America is one of the hardest hit regions in terms of cases, in terms of deaths, in terms of the economy and the challenges there. And so I think there's a real space for the U.S. administration to help with, you know, vaccine attainment and distribution. So those two things, I think, are going to be the immediate things, along with these longer term institution building things that we might talk about.
Shannon, what I think I hear you saying is that if the Biden team thinks it is going to make China its foreign policy priority, or countering Russian hacking its number one priority, or doing something about Iran's nuclear program as its number one priority, what it's going to discover is that issues in Latin America are going to force their way onto the Biden agenda. I take it that migration may be leading the list there. So let's talk about that, Paul. Let's talk about, as you point out, it could be the first crisis of a Biden presidency. I think there are actually several contenders for that. I talk to people in the Middle East, they all point to Iran. And obviously, we're getting a crisis right now with Russian hacking. But what can the Biden administration do early on to deal with this budding crisis that you see?
Right. Well, I think that the Biden administration will certainly be more welcoming to asylum seekers and refugees in the long run. But, you know, I think in terms of repealing a lot of the instruments that comprise the Trump administration's migration strategy, for instance, the Remain in Mexico policy and migrant protection protocols, I don't see the Biden administration revoking that right away. Doing so would be an unmitigated disaster, as there are currently 70,000 people who are residing on the Mexico side of the U.S.-Mexico border waiting for their asylum hearing in U.S. immigration courts. Additionally, as Shannon pointed to, there are major public health concerns given that the spaces where these migrants and asylum seekers are living on the Mexican side of the border are ripe for COVID transmission. And so I think dismantling that will be very difficult for the Biden administration in its first months. But there are some things that the Biden administration has signaled that it intends to do. The first would be to extend temporary protected status to Venezuelans who are living in the United States. This is a campaign promise that the Biden-Harris campaign made, and I do believe they intend to keep in the first weeks of the Biden administration. Additionally, the Trump administration just reauthorized temporary protected status for Central Americans from Nicaragua, Honduras, and El Salvador in the wake of hurricanes Eta and Iota. And I do believe that the Biden administration will take early and decisive action on deferred action for childhood arrivals, DACA, and will ensure that there are protections extended to our 700,000 dreamers in the United States. The Biden administration is also in the migration realm signaled that it intends to create a pathway to citizenship for 11 million undocumented individuals in the United States. But I think the traction on that issue will depend or hinge entirely on what happens in the Georgia Senate race. In terms of what the Biden administration can do on the ground to prevent the surge of migrants coming to the U.S.-Mexico border, I think there's going to have to be an early emphasis on cooperation with the López Obrador administration in Mexico for Mexico to continue to control its northern and southern borders. The Obama administration had previously looked very closely with Enrique Peña Nieto administration in Mexico on a southern border strategy to limit the flow of Central American and third country nationals accessing Mexican territory via the porous Mexico-Guatemala border. And I think that we will probably see an initial return to that kind of strategy.
Let me ask Shannon about that, because obviously you've done a lot of work, Shannon, on this. López Obrador has been a help, at least in the eyes of the Trump administration, by sort of suppressing the northward flow of migration. Again, for the Biden administration, if you do get a migration crisis at the border, it's going to be a domestic political problem here at home. Kashoor is shooting. Republicans are going to criticize Democrats for failing to anticipate or handle the problem. And to the extent a Biden administration takes any pages out of the Trump migration playbook, they'll be accused of hypocrisy. So how does the Biden administration approach that with Mexico, given also, I would imagine, there are lots of other issues in the bilateral relationship between Washington and Mexico City?
There are a lot of other issues. So just first to touch on the migration, I mean, this is going to be an intricate negotiation. Already, the Mexican officials, the foreign minister and others have come out and said, you know, maybe there are going to be more Central Americans coming to the border. So they're already talking about opening that up a bit and trying to change the policies without the sort of draconian punitive threats that they had under the Trump administration. They're not expecting the Biden administration to do that. But I do see some areas here on this issue that I could imagine the U.S. and Mexico cooperating on. And, you know, as Paul mentioned, under the previous administration, under Peña Nieto, before López Obrador, there was cooperation on keeping Central Americans in Central America. There's also a challenge that López Obrador faces in his own country in that, you know, the tens of thousands of Central Americans coming into Mexico, they don't all make it up to the southern border and they settle in all parts of Mexico. And there's a tension between Mexicans and Central Americans that come that isn't unlike some of the tensions we have in our own countries. Worry about Guatemalans, Hondurans taking Mexican jobs or, you know, entering different parts of the cities, they're different or they're seen as different. They have different accents or they have different customs and food and things like that. So you know, I think there is a domestic reason for López Obrador to not want lots of Central Americans to come north and cross the border. You know, and then the other thing I think where we could see some sort of cooperation is that López Obrador, when he came into office 2 years ago, he promised a big Marshall Plan-like effort in Central America from Mexico. He saw himself as a sort of grand statesman in Central America. And the Biden campaign talked about that on the trail. They talked about $4 billion for Central America over 4 years during the first term. And so I could perhaps see where there'd be a way for Mexico and the United States to work together to address what people usually call the root causes in Central America, making it a more safe, stable, economically prosperous place for people to stay. So migration, perhaps there's a path forward there that I can see. Some of the other issues on the U.S.-Mexico relationship are pretty sticky. And one particular one I'll just point out is security issues. So we've seen this last week, you saw a law passed through the Mexican Congress that would really limit the operations of U.S. law enforcement. They wouldn't have diplomatic immunity. They'd have to report information that they got to the foreign ministry. And so I think that is going to be, as we see a new administration come in the U.S., I think one of the first things to negotiate is going to be if and how the U.S. security cooperation with Mexico is going to work.
Well, Paul, let me pick up on that theme, because drugs and security is an issue not just in the bilateral relationship. It's really a regional issue. And obviously, you know, the purpose of Plan Colombia was to attack that issue in the context of Colombia and more broadly in the region. So how do you think the Biden administration is going to sort of pick up on that issue outside of Mexico?
Yeah, well, I think one of the trends that we've noticed on the security front throughout Latin America during COVID-19 is really the acceleration of the militarization of law enforcement. Militaries are being called in across the region to enforce COVID-19 lockdowns, to manage public order, to administer vaccinations when vaccinations become available, and in places like Mexico, even performing public works projects and building infrastructure. And this is across the region has affected the popularity of militaries quite negatively, because the more that these militaries interface with the citizenry, they tend to be more prone to corruption or committing abuses. And, you know, this is, I think, points to a larger issue that will be front and center for the Biden administration on the security front, is encouraging and building accountability for security institutions, not just militaries, but also law enforcement institutions. You know, the recent case of General Cienfuegos, who was the head of the Mexican army, who was indicted on charges of collaboration with drug trafficking organization. There's always been this argument in Latin America that it's just individual bad eggs, that these aren't institutional problems. But I think, you know, in the case of Mexico, we noticed that with the former Secretary of Public Security, Garcia Luna, and General Cienfuegos, that, you know, if there's corruption at the highest level, then there is a more institutional problem. Likewise, Colombia, our closest military partner in the region, the Colombian military's popularity this year dipped below 50% for the first time in 20 years in the wake of a scandal in which military intelligence units were spying on international journalists and civil society organizations. Rebuilding that credibility capability will be an important element of U.S. defense policy going forward so that we can rely on our longstanding partners in the region to help implement collaborative security policy.
Shannon, there's one other big issue that I want to touch upon, and that's trade. And I really want to focus particularly on one slice of trade, and that is the USMCA, the United States, Mexico, Canada trade agreement. It's the successor to NAFTA. We can argue about whether it was a good or bad successor to NAFTA, but it's there. And a big part of the revision was imposing a host of new requirements on Mexico in terms of labor rights and making sure people were paid in the auto industry certain levels. My sense is there's some unhappiness here in the United States about Mexico's compliance with the agreement. So sort of spell out for me where you think the trade issue is going to go between the United States and Mexico.
So that's a great question. And there are a couple things within the new USMCA that are going to be top of the agenda, in part because they're new mechanisms to be used, in part because of the interests of the new incoming Biden administration and the Democrats in general in Congress. So let me talk about two of those. And one is the one you point out, which is labor. So there's a new mechanism that allows the U.S. to oversee and be more involved in making sure that there's sort of fair labor practices on the factory floor in Mexico. And the reverse, Mexicans can look and make sure that we have fair labor practices on our factory floors. This has not yet been tested or used. The treaty just came into operation the beginning of July in 2020. So it's just starting out. But there are cases being built today, I know, in the United States, in a couple of circumstances that are going to test this. So this is going to be a big issue, I do think, for 2021, how Mexico responds when there is outside oversight into what's happening in its labor market. So that's one issue that could cause tensions, though there, you know, there could also be some forces in Mexico, labor unions down in Mexico, that would like some changes on the labor floor. Because face it, there are a lot of companies down there that are not particularly kind to their workers or follow quote unquote fair labor practices as defined by the ILO or other big international organizations. The other issue that I do think we're going to see in 2021 between Mexico and the United States, or one of the issues involving USMCA, is issues of the environment and energy. And so this last year, in the last few months, we have seen complaints from US energy companies who feel that their rights in the contracts that they have signed over the last 3 or 4 years have been eroded or even abrogated. So they are right now within domestic courts in Mexico suing the Mexican government to try to stop some of the moves and changes that regulators have made or the government has announced. And they have turned to the United States government. The Trump administration, the executive branch, has not responded, but the U.S. Congress, over 36 senators and representatives from both sides of the aisle, signed a letter worried about these issues. So I think you're going to see a Biden administration much more interested in defending the rights of U.S. companies in Mexico. And the new USMCA makes it very clear that they can do that in the case of energy companies. So those are two big issues on the trade front. We're going to see USMCA playing a big role in 2021.
Well, Shannon, you have nicely teed up the question I wanted to ask Paul, and it goes back to a point he made earlier when he referenced the Georgia Senate races, and that is, what kind of reception or pressure is a Biden administration going to feel from Capitol Hill on issues related to Latin America? Is it the case that the administration is going to essentially face the same sort of polarization on the Hill with Republicans pushing for one set of policy, Democrats for another set of policies, or their cross-cutting coalitions that are building up that will either help or hurt the administration? If you just give us a sense of sort of what the diplomacy at home is going to look like. You spent a lot of time talking about the diplomacy abroad.
Sure. And I think, you know, on the issue of migration, you know, it remains to be seen what happens in those Georgia Senate races and what kind of collaborative path forward on actually enacting an immigration reform, what kind of possibilities we have for that. But I think one area where we can find consensus across the aisle is on the issue of China and China's presence in the region. You know, the U.S. Department of Defense is now operating under the pretext of a global order in which there exists great power competition. And although in the American because our competition with Beijing has not actually materialized in military terms, China is increasingly engaged on the economic and diplomatic front in the Americas. Whereas at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, China was surging PPE and critical medical equipment to Latin America, the Trump administration was cutting off the export of those goods in the earliest days of the pandemic, which severely eroded U.S. standing with longstanding partners. And now, you know, China is front and center in providing for vaccines vaccine access to many of the countries of Latin America. And I think that there will be, as Shannon alluded to, an early consensus that the United States needs to help its neighbors. I think it makes sense for the United States to participate in an equitable vaccine distribution throughout the region. But likewise, China is providing important lines of credit to cash-strapped governments in the region. The regional GDP is set to contract by 9% this year. In recent years, we've seen countries like Panama, the Dominican Republic, and El Salvador all reverse course on the recognition of Taiwan in exchange for major infrastructure developments. And this is where I think that we have bipartisan consensus in Congress on using the new Development Finance Corporation as an important tool for shoring up U.S. private sector investments in Latin America. So far, the DFC's investments in Latin America don't have really much to show for themselves, but the recently announced America's Crece initiative, the America's Growth Initiative, is a sort of a promising signal that has received backing from both sides of the aisle and would certainly be welcomed by our longstanding partners in the Latin America Caribbean region.
Paul, I'm really glad you raised the China issue because it resonates with me because I just finished reading an op-ed that Senator Tim Kaine, the former Democratic vice presidential candidate, wrote in The Hill, and he raised just this issue, and he talks about how he was talking to a leading official in South America, and the official said to Senator Kaine, "We really want to work with Americans, but you're largely absent from the region, and the Chinese are very present, so we work more with them." And so I think that's something, obviously, to pay attention to as we go forward. Shannon, do you have a sense of what it is a Biden administration could do about that?
You know, I think what we could see are sort of both carrots and sticks. So the sticks would be, we have seen some pressure, for instance, on Brazil. Brazil is going to do a big 5G auction at the beginning of 2021 and keeping Huawei out of it, right? That has been already in the works. And I think we'll start to see, as the world splits on some of those issues and sort of technology, hardware, and infrastructure, you could see more pressure from the U.S. on which side Latin American countries are choosing in terms of the China-U.S. split. But as Paul was talking about, I think perhaps we could start seeing a little bit more incentives. And, you know, as that op-ed and probably who Tim Kaine was talking with, you know, we want our companies to go down there. We want our infrastructure to go down there and the like, but we don't provide a lot of financing to help that happen. And lots of other countries around the world have, you know, import-export banks or other kinds of development financing that comes along with it. And, you know, China has this big Belt and Road Initiative that it's gone to lots of countries, including Latin American countries in that process. And so I think the real challenge for Biden administration is if you want to really gain the attention of those who have auctions for roads and rails and ports and airports and internet and electricity grids and all these kinds of things, you need to provide some incentives along the way. So how they're going to do that. And there is, I think, back to your question about how much does Georgia matter? As we go into 2021, it's going to be lean times in the United States, especially if we see a Republican-controlled Senate. I think stimulus packages for the United States are going to be hard to come by. And it's going to be hard to increase overseas development assistance or even overseas development financing. So I think there it's a real question. The domestic politics may play into the ability for the United States to counter China in this particular way in the companies that are out there, not just in Latin America, but in the, you know, emerging markets more broadly.
I think you're quite right on that point, Shannon. I do think we're already seeing signs, and we're seeing it over the debate on the relief or stimulus bill right now, of Republicans reverting to a more traditional anti-deficit, deficit hawk position that's going to carry over, I think, and intensify under the Biden administration. I'd like to close our conversation by asking both of you to put your prediction hats on and sort of look at where you think U.S.-Latin America relations will be a year from now. Are we looking at a world that's going to look pretty much as it does right now? Are we going to see big breakthroughs with a new era of cooperation? Are we going to go back to an older period of hostility and enmity over American interventionism and overbearing Washington? Something else entirely different? Maybe if I could begin with you, Paul.
Yeah, I think that the Biden-Harris administration will really fall back on this rhetoric and narrative of partnership with the Americas. Given that Bolsonaro and Lopez Obrador, the leaders of the two largest economies of the region, delayed so long in recognizing Biden's victory, I don't see any initial wins or big opportunities in either of those countries for the first year. But I do see, given the Biden campaign's commitment to addressing the root causes of migration from Central America and its intent to ask Congress for $4 billion of assistance to be implemented implemented over 4 years. So potential early wins for the anti-corruption and democratic institution building in the Northern Triangle countries of Central America. Likewise, I would also suggest that the U.S. government right now has an opportunity with the Caribbean Basin, and particularly the Caribbean nations. You know, the Caribbean nations had long been subject to Venezuela's outsized geopolitical influence through a subsidized oil scheme known as Petrocaribe, which has now ended. And I think this opens the door to a new possibility for U.S. multilateral engagement in the hemisphere, which could potentially give teeth to the Organization of the American States and its democratic charter. I think that the U.S. government will seek to use the Summit of the Americas next year as an opportunity to corral solidarity in defense of democracy throughout the hemisphere and to corral partnership for dealing with those countries that have slipped through the cracks, namely Venezuela and Nicaragua. And I would also offer that the Vice President-elect's Jamaican heritage would give us new cachet with regional partners in the Caribbean, and recognizing that the security of the Caribbean, be it environmental security, health security, citizen security, is inextricably linked to our own security. This is our neighborhood, and what happens in one part of the community will certainly have knock-on effects elsewhere. And so when I'm thinking of bright spots or silver lining going forward for the first year of the Biden-Harris administration in the region, I see Central America and the Caribbean as the most auspicious opportunities.
Fair enough. Shannon, where do you think we'll be a year from now?
So I think U.S.-Latin America relations in 2021 is going to be a lot about giving relief. We're going to see relief on COVID. So I think the U.S. will step in and try to help with vaccine distribution and attainment and the like. I think you're going to see a big push for relief on migration. Some of this is very self-interested. The U.S. worried about what happens at their southern border. But overall, a turn to trying to relieve the humanitarian crises that are happening in many, many countries around the region. And this, I want to say, is a big change from the last 4 years where we saw much more transactional approach in terms of the back and forth. I think there'll be a giving to the region or sort of laying out without asking for something immediately in return. But the other thing is, so these are going to be the big themes. If I can summarize big themes for, you know, 30 plus countries, which is always hard to do. But the other thing, just to go back to one place where you started, is there are going to be a lot of urgent and very high profile issues on the Biden agenda. And some of them are going to be international. They're going to be Iran and Russia and China. And a lot are going to be totally domestic and economic recovery and the like. And those are going to take a lot of the oxygen. But some of the things that are happening in Latin America and some of the decisions this administration is going to make over the next year or 4 years, a lot of these issues are really important, if not urgent. And so how we work with Mexico, how we work with Central America, how we work with all of the countries in the region is going to matter. And a lot of that's going to be day-to-day, back and forth, bureaucratic partnerships and cooperation. And a return to that, I think that is also going to be part of that first year.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guests have been Paul Angelo, Fellow for Latin America Studies, and Shannon O'Neill, Vice President, Nelson, and David Rockefeller, Senior Fellow for Latin America Studies at CFR. Paul and Shannon, thanks for joining me.
It was great to be here.
Thanks so much, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.